From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
On this week's show, is Google Fiber enough to attract high-tech businesses? Local businesses pitch in to offer more incentives.
My nightmare is waking up in 3 or 4 years and saying, well, Kansas City had this wonderful opportunity. They were ahead of everybody else, but they didn't realize how to take advantage of it.
Plus the dirty tale of cowtails and the dairy business.
So you've got a mouthful of feces and urine in the eyes. If a cow has a tail, it's going to happen.
And inside the Kansas City Symphony, through the eyes and ears of the conductor.
The conductor is the only person of the 85 to 100 people on that stage that does not make any sound.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Part of the hype that's come with Google Fiber is how great the super-fast internet speed could be for IT businesses. But is Google Fiber enough to attract the world's high-tech entrepreneurs to Kansas City, especially when the technology will probably spread to other cities within the next few years? Last week, local business leaders and politicians proposed a plan called Launch KC to sweeten the pot for potential new IT companies. Alex Smith has the story.
The giant window of Mike Burke's office provides a panoramic view of Crown Center, Liberty Memorial, and a big chunk of Midtown. From this 21st-story perch, the lawyer and former city councilman can see a lot of what's happening in town. But late last year, when he wanted to see what the city was doing to court entrepreneurs, he had to pick up the phone.
Last December, I called up our Economic Development Corporation, and I just posed a hypothetical. I said, I'm Joe from Cincinnati. I'm intrigued by the high-speed fiber in Kansas City and everything that is going on there. I don't know a soul in Kansas City, but I've got a four-person firm. We'd like to move there and work on developing our ideas. What can you do for us, and where can you put us? And at that time, the answer was, we'll get back to you. They didn't have an answer because they really hadn't delved into what a startup needs, to what the attractive points are, to what private industry can do, and to what role government should play.
So Burke, who's also chair of the mayor's bi-state innovation team, started reaching out to Kansas City IT businesses to find out what the city ought to do.
In talking with the tech community, I'll even use the word geek community because many of them wear that badge proudly. They said, here's what we need. We need Wi-Fi in our business districts. We need access to data storage that is geared to assist the startups. We need a proof of concept center where we can go and work with professionals and have the equipment that we can test our applications, test our products, and we need people to introduce us around.
What came out of these discussions was a plan called Launch KC. It's a joint project involving big Kansas City businesses like Hallmark and DST Systems to offer incentives to entrepreneurs. In addition to the free Wi-Fi, data storage, and proof of concept center, they also came up with mentoring programs, startup financing, and free to cheap office space. The KCMO City Council is also trying to pitch in.
What the city can do, and the mayor's going to be introducing this ordinance, is some sale-leaseback arrangements on equipment, on computers, on screens, and all the little things that a startup company would need.
Mike Burke recently announced Launch KC along with the mayor in the Crossroads District. This is where a lot of the free or cheap office space they're providing is located. He says the neighborhood is ideal for attracting the kind of people we need.
Cities don't say we're going to create a geek district and all you geeks move there. We did just the opposite. We talked with tech people and followed where they are, what type of environment they're looking for. And, you know, they're not looking for the glass cube on 435. They're looking for a neighborhood that has a real urban feel to it, that has quirky little hangouts, whether it's coffee shops or restaurants or barbershop. And that's why Crossroads and West Bottoms and River Market and 18th and Vine all kind of popped up. Those are the areas, along with Hospital Hill, that we're focusing on, because that's where the tech communities are already. We're following them rather than they're following us.
But why are all these big companies so eager to help out what might be future competition? Burke says it's really about growing the overall metro economy and its technical capabilities.
The big picture is that we, Kansas City, and Kansas City businesses, are in a competition with every other city in the world for talent. And Google estimates that by 2020, which isn't that far away, there will be 2.5 tech jobs for every person trained to fill those jobs. So it's the cities that are going to succeed are the cities that can attract, train, nurture, keep, steal talent. And Kansas City is well positioned in that. We're an inexpensive city to live in. We already have a great tech community here. By taking it to the next level with Launch KC, we hope to enhance those districts that are very tech-friendly districts. And from the point of view of the larger companies, even the ones that are not tech companies are very tech-dependent. A bank in this day and age is very tech-dependent. Even a little retail shop on the corner is tech-dependent. Having enough trained people to fill the jobs is certainly in their best interest.
Now, if you're talking about jobs, high-tech startups don't employ anywhere near the number of businesses that a big factory or a corporation might. But Burke still believes attracting IT entrepreneurs should be a priority.
One thing I've learned in 40 years of economic development work is you don't go steal a Fortune 500 company from another city. You grow them in your own city. Hallmark is homegrown, and Garmin is homegrown, Sprint is homegrown, DST is homegrown, and Cerner is certainly homegrown. We need to grow the businesses of the future in Kansas City. We're a wonderful climate for that. And if we can attract the right kind of talent, and doing it in the way we are with Launch KC, not only interests the small entrepreneur, but guess who else it interests? It interests the companies that are searching for people to fill their tech jobs. If we create the incubator, if we create the atmosphere, if we create the districts, if we create the buzz that Kansas City is the place for people of talent to go, certainly that's going to have dividends for us that will extend decades.
What Launch KC wants to steer the metro area away from is Kansas and Missouri fighting each other for jobs.
To spend $45 million to move a company across the state line is insanity. We need to put a stop to it. If we're going to spend that kind of incentive money, we ought to be spending it moving companies from San Francisco or Boston or Chicago or New York to Kansas City. I think Mayor Reardon understands that. Mayor James certainly understands that. And I think our civic leaders understand that. Some of the political leaders don't.
Of course, Launch KC was inspired by Google Fiber. The high-speed network has come with a lot of big promises about what it could mean for business. But Mike Burke says fiber is not enough. Launch KC is needed so the city can take the next step.
Just having high-speed fiber in and of itself does not make Kansas City, won't make Kansas City the great digital crossroads. All it does is get faster downloads for movies at home. What we really realized once we started looking at it, it's what we do to take advantage of the opportunity that has been handed us. We will be the fastest download city in the United States. But we're only going to be the fastest download city for a short period of time. It may be a year or two or three at most. But other cities are already onto this. They're financing either privately or publicly, expanding fiber within their communities. There's a group that's raised $200 million to work with university towns to extend high-speed fiber. So it's a fleeting opportunity, and if we don't take advantage of it and take advantage of it, some other city will. My nightmare is waking up in 3 or 4 years and saying, well, Kansas City had this wonderful opportunity. They were ahead of everybody else, but they didn't realize how to take advantage of it.
The city council is soon expected to consider the measure to get rid of property and sales tax for certain purchases by IT entrepreneurs. For Casey Currents, this is Alex Smith. Nebraska irrigates more acres of farmland than any state in the region. Kansas is also near the top, and that irrigation infrastructure helped some Midwestern farmers keep the drought at bay this year. Their fields stayed green long after others withered away. But as Grant Gerlach reports for Harvest Public Media, using so much water now may force some farmers to use less water in the future.
Near Grand Island, Nebraska, on a windy afternoon in mid-September, hamburgers sizzle on a hot charcoal grill outside a food stand at Husker Harvest Days, an annual farm show focused on irrigated agriculture. In this water-troubled year, there's plenty to talk about. I ask Skip Kelly from the north-central town of Page about the harvest as he's sitting down for lunch. Kelly says when he started running his combine through his non-irrigated cornfields, he wasn't sure what he would find.
The hills were burnt up. There were 0 bushels on the hills. Only yields come out of the low ground. Yielded 50 bushels.
That's 50 bushels of corn per acre. Could have been worse, Kelly says. But in fields where he pumps groundwater for irrigation, he could bring in 3, maybe 4 times that.
Well, we've been hearing reports over 200. So a lot of guys are hoping for 185 to 200. That would be very good.
That would be close to normal in one of the driest years on record. With corn prices riding high, that's quite the competitive advantage. Consider that a University of Nebraska-Lincoln study says the drought could shrink corn yields by 40% in dryland fields in Iowa, while yields for irrigated corn in Nebraska may end up only 8% lower than expected. But Mike Clements wonders whether there will be enough water for next year.
When the numbers come in, I think they are going to be astronomical.
Clements is manager of the Lower Republican Natural Resources District, which regulates groundwater irrigation for a portion of south central Nebraska. He says farmers in his area saved up water allowances over the last couple of wet years and then poured it on this summer. The impact is unmistakable when he looks at the Harlan County Reservoir from his office window.
At the beginning of the irrigation season, this reservoir was over a foot into the flood pool. I mean, it was full, plumb full. Now it has dropped about 10 feet.
If the Harlan County Reservoir stays at its current low level, it could trigger restrictions on irrigation in southern Nebraska. Linda Fox of Pratt, Kansas, is already working under water restrictions. Fox farms corn and soybeans, along with some wheat and cotton in south central Kansas, where she says the drought started last year.
Everybody overpumped. Everybody tried to, finish their crops that they had in the ground. And the state is monitoring us, and yes, we are having to cut back this year.
Lane Letourneau manages water appropriations for the Kansas Division of Water Resources. He says temporary restrictions are possible for farmers like Fox, but many people are avoiding penalties by signing up for new multi-year irrigation accounts. Letourneau says it allows farmers to pump extra water in 2012, but will force them to conserve water later. The goal is to even out losses from sources like the Ogallala Aquifer.
We are seeing huge declines, like right south of Garden City. We saw, 10 feet of decline in, on average just in 1 year. We've seen 28 feet over the last 3 years, and so there's some areas very concerning to us.
Normal rain and a snowy winter in the Rockies could quickly refill diminished rivers and reservoirs in Nebraska and Kansas, but underground aquifers are slower to respond. So while irrigation kept many farmers from feeling the worst of the drought in 2012, some farmers may need to give their water sources some time off to keep their edge in dry years ahead. I'm Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
To dock or not to dock? That is the question some Midwest dairy farmers are debating now that the National Milk Producers Federation has taken a stand against the widespread practice of cutting off cow tails. Harvest Public Media's Abby Fentress Swanson explores why this isn't just a cut-and-dried decision.
Most people who haven't milked a cow might think of it as a sort of back-to-the-land moment. Just you and your cow out in the barn communing with nature. Milk her for a while and voila, fresh, creamy milk. But the truth is, milking can be a very, very dirty job.
I have been hit many, many times right in the face by a tail with manure.
That's Matt Waldron. He teaches dairy nutrition and health at the University of Missouri. Looking at his office with its life-sized cardboard cutout of a black and white Holstein, it's no surprise he's worked on dairies most of his life. Or that he's gotten whacked in the face with a wet, smelly cow tail more times than he can count.
And all of a sudden you go to step out of the stall and there she just whacks it right completely across your face, in your mouth. You were talking to another person over on the other side of the barn at the same time when she hit you in the mouth. And so you've got a mouthful of feces and urine in the eyes.
Wow.
If a cow has a tail, it's going to happen.
That's a big if, though, because many dairy producers cut off or dock their cows' tails. It's a practice that was introduced in the New Zealand dairy industry in the early 1900s, and it wasn't just about inconvenience. Cow tails were thought to be the cause of an outbreak of leptospirosis among milkers, a disease caused by bacteria found in animal urine. Dairy producers in the U.S. got in on the practice, in part because they believed docking also led to cleaner cows. But recent studies show there's no scientific proof that docking keeps cows healthier or that it stops the spread of disease. It's also less of a concern today, according to Waldron, because workers have less contact with cows in modern milking parlors. Now just half the dairies in the U.S. dock their cows' tails, according to the latest study done by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Docking is more common on the East Coast and in the Midwest, though. Missouri's largest dairy, Heartland Creamery, docks its 3,900 milking cows' tails down to short little stubs. Here's Joe Vian, the dairy manager at Heartland.
It's our whole program right now. That is the standard operating procedure for Heartland Dairy, is to dock the tails at 24 months of age.
Heartland doesn't dock the tails until the cows are ready to milk. They first cut the lower quarters of the tails off and then apply tight rubber rings to the new ends of the tails to cut off blood circulation. Vian says he doesn't think it hurts a cow more than a piercing would.
It's not a drawn-out process that we take the tails off. It's as quick and as painless as we can possibly do it for them.
He says docking helps keep their cows from getting mastitis. That's an udder infection caused by bacteria, which can keep cows from producing milk. Keeping the cows healthy is a top priority at Heartland. Heartland Creamery is a business, though, and VN says getting through the worst drought in decades is more of a concern for him than whether or not to dock his cows' tails. But public opinion may hold the trump card here. Noted animal advocate Temple Grandin teaches animal science at Colorado State University.
A lot of people that want to dock cows just want to do it for convenience, the milkers. They don't want to get slimed by tails.
Grandin says she's seen more flies on cows with docked tails because they don't have tails to flick them off. Many dairies have also given up on tours because they're tired of explaining to visitors why the cows look so funny.
I think in ag, we got to look at everything that we do and go, could you explain this from the wedding guests from New York or Chicago? And you know, you see a cow out there covered with flies, wiggling a nubbin. I don't think that's something we want to show the wedding guests.
Bearing in mind public opinion is one of the reasons that the National Milk Producers Federation voted this summer to take a stand against docking. Like Grandin, the industry trade group says there's no science behind the benefits to docking, and so it's urging producers to stop the practice by 2022. For opponents of docking, 10 years is way too long, though. The Humane Society, for example, says the practice causes cows unnecessary pain and it should be stopped immediately. But there is an alternative to cowtail docking, and it's being done at the Foremost Dairy in Columbia, Missouri. Fall is a busy time at the University of Missouri-owned dairy. It's a time of year when veterinarian Scott Polk trims the switches off the tails of the dairy's 425 cows. In his blue jumpsuit, rubber boots, and baseball cap, Polk demonstrates the procedure. He sidles up to a big Holstein with an ordinary pipe cutter in his hand.
We're going to take off her ponytail is what we're doing.
With the other hand, he picks up the cow's 3.5-foot long tail.
I have to find the end of her tail bones. Okay, obviously we don't want to cut that.
Polk takes hold of the long curly hair at the end of her tail and uses his pipe cutter to cut.
Cut that. So it's just like getting a haircut.
And did she feel that at all, do you think?
No, just like you getting your hair cut. Don't feel it.
Increasingly, livestock producers who don't dock are trimming cowtail switches like Polk does. California and Rhode Island have banned tail docking, and Ohio is moving to phase out the practice by 2018. Abby Fentress-Swanson, Harvest Public Media.
Still to come, the history of Shawnee Mission, which was actually a mission for the Shawnee tribe transplanted from the native territory. That story ahead. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
Sitting on the old Santa Fe Trail, Shawnee Mission was originally a mission for Native Americans. The story of these missions is a tale of clashing cultural perspectives. One side sees brave, compassionate missionaries who sacrifice to provide Native people with a better life through Christianity.
But in the eyes of many indigenous people, forcibly removing Native Americans from their land and resettling them in the Kansas colonies was cultural genocide. Last spring, Susan caught up with Ty Edwards, professor at Johnson County Community College, to learn more.
Shawnee Mission is part of the larger, broader context of missionization in America. Shawnee Mission in particular was a mission for a removed population, so Native people that had lived in the Old Northwest that were forcibly removed to Kansas as a way to open up their land to American settlement and American development. This was extremely difficult for the Shawnee people moving to Kansas, and it was difficult for the Native people that already lived here, having new neighbors, having to share resources, and learning to get along with one another in this place. And then, of course, missionization, as we talked about, the Shawnee Mission is a place of attempting to convert Native peoples, and it's an attempt to forcibly convert them to a way of life that's foreign in many ways to them and that they're not necessarily choosing. And so that is a complicated process. People resist it. It can be violent and it can be brutal. And it's an important part of Kansas's history.
Shawnee Indians in this area, along with many other eastern tribes, were moved to present-day Kansas in the 1800s. What was it like for the Indians that were relocated here?
Well, removal was always a very brutal process. It meant abandoning homeland, home communities, and in particular, remains of the deceased. And it often involved poverty and suffering en route and poverty and suffering when arrived. And that was all to open up land for American settlers in homeland, which for Shawnees and others was places like the Old Northwest, including Indiana, Ohio, and Illinois. So it was a brutal experience.
What was the motivation for starting missions in the first place?
Well, the whole process of acquiring Native land was justified because civilization was viewed, of course, the United States and European nations had the paramount civilizations of the time, and Native peoples were viewed as savages who needed to be converted to the ways of modern civilization. So although they might be resistant to this, the United States and Europeans before them, of course, too, were going to forcibly provide the teachings of civilization to Natives, and this involved missions, and Christianity is a big part of that.
So when you say civilization, what did civilization actually mean?
Well, civilization meant democratic governing institutions. It meant a Christian religious belief. It meant a Christian European standard of gender division. So women in domestic roles, men as farmers and other outside of the home roles. And also things like dividing a family up into nuclear family units rather than clan identities and larger communities. And those are the things that needed to be changed about Native life. Private property ownership, too, is a big part of that.
So several religious groups were actually involved in this missionization process. What were some of them?
That's very true. Catholic denominations were involved, including foreign immigrants from various European nations coming to be part of Catholic missions. And then Protestant denominations all across the country also were involved in missionization for Natives.
So not that there's a typical profile, but if there were a typical profile of a missionary back then, what would they tend to look like?
Well, it definitely depended on if you were a Catholic missionary or a Protestant missionary. If you were a Catholic missionary, it was usually priests and nuns. So they came as individuals or part of groups of priests and nuns. Whereas if you were a Protestant missionary, you often came as your entire family. So a minister and his wife and his children would be all part of their mission work together. So depending on your Christianity, you came as family units or sometimes you came as individuals.
Now, there were also a number of tribes involved in missionization. Did the way they run the mission have anything to do with the tribes involved, or was it a one-size-fit-all kind of?
Well, there was always diversity, of course, because of the differences in tribal experiences and their locations. But there was an overwhelming similarity in goals to make, in particular, women who had been the primary farmers in native communities stop being the farmers, make men become the farmers, have them live in nuclear family households separated from one another in sort of individual farmsteads, as we would think of them. And that was sort of the main goal. And then, of course, teach Christian values.
Were there examples back then of resistance to missionization?
Certainly. For example, some native people that continued to hunt and gather would often spend significant amounts of time away from the mission during the year. And the further you were away from the mission, then the less influence they had on your life. And native peoples knew that they could use that as sometimes an excuse to get away from missionaries and a way to preserve culture. And then also missionaries frequently attempted to open schools for Native kids. They thought that adults would be harder to change and children would be easier to change. So another way that Native people frequently resisted was taking their children from the schools or never sending their kids to the schools in the first place. And sometimes they would use the schools as a place for their kids to learn English. And then once that was accomplished, then the children didn't need to go to school anymore and they would abandon the education system.
Were there any other prominent missions in our area that you can talk about?
Yeah, for example, the one that I do a lot of my research on is the Osage Mission, which is in southeast Kansas. But it was a Catholic mission, so it had a lot of those sort of characteristics in terms of having several single priests and a lot of nuns that came to educate the children and change culture. But missions were widespread in Kansas because Kansas was actually originally part of Indian Territory. We usually assume Indian Territory was just what is now present-day Oklahoma, but Kansas and parts of Nebraska were all part of original Indian Territory, and each Native nation had some kind of civilization missionary attempt inside of it, sometimes combined. Potawatomis had missions, Kickapoos had missions. All of the Native nations that eventually moved to Kansas would experience missionization.
When I read about missionaries, I mean, I read about people who were really lauded in their time for doing a good thing.
Missionaries definitely believed that they were performing both man's and God's work, all right? So they were helping Native people to come to the gospel and change their ways that were going to be required to survive in the modern world. A lot of people believed that indigenous populations were going to go extinct. And so missionaries believed they were literally preserving human lives by providing access to modern technology, modern farming, and then, of course, in their minds, eternal life through Christianity. And it is true that a lot of missionaries endured enormous hardships for themselves and, in Protestant cases, their families, which was brutal for them, too. But what was the larger context is this was all part of a cultural assault on Native people. And it's all rooted in the view that Native people were savage and inferior and could not survive in society as they were, which of course was not necessarily true. However, in each instance, Native people and missionaries often did find ways to sort of coexist and find benefit from one another. Medical advice was something that missionaries could frequently provide to Native people and assistance in medical care because a lot of Native people, once they reached the missionization stage, were often brutalized by disease from poor diets and assaults from settlers and other things. And often missionaries, whether they knew it or not, acted as intermediaries between tribes and the government. And many Native peoples used their missionaries as ways to broker deals with the federal government that they might have had struggled to do without them.
So it was kind of a mixed bag. It sounds like some Indians may have felt, well, this could be a good thing and you know, I'm getting some benefits from this. But then others regarded it as a kind of a cultural genocide.
Certainly. And I think you have to say that regardless of what sort of cooperation they could find with one another. The overwhelming goal was cultural genocide, and the overwhelming impact of missionaries and the Civilization Program in general on Native communities in the United States was tremendous suffering and assault.
Now, you mentioned the Christian boarding schools that the Indian youth were sent because they could be shaped and molded. There are reports, for example, that those youth were not allowed to speak their language. They were punished or practicing Indian traditions. How much of that is borne out by the history?
A lot, particularly when we get to the boarding schools that emerged in the 1870s and well into the 20th century. The assaults on Native children were enormous. All kinds of assaults on their cultural views, such as cutting hair, violence towards kids who spoke their native language or practiced any of their Native religious practices, were intense. There is a lot of evidence of disease and inadequate medical care provided to the kids in these places, in boarding schools. There's a lot of imprisonment and harsh punishment. Jails were actually part of all of the boarding schools' designs when they were built, so it was a very strict environment. And suffering in boarding schools was intense for all the obvious reasons, but also separation from families. You learned your cultural views from your parents, and by being separated from them, this will sometimes separate children permanently and generations permanently from their cultural views they're not learning from parents and elders.
Now, as far as the practice of Native religion, how was that impacted by this whole missionization process?
Enormous. This is, of course, attempting to displace Native religious views with Christian religious views. And in many ways, Native people will attempt to compromise between those things. They will attempt to resist full abandonment of their Native religion, will attempt to merge it with Christian views that in some ways exists to the present in a lot of Native communities. But by so doing, by having Christian religious practices instead of Native religious practices, once you're not practicing those things, they have less and less significance in your life and less ability to teach them to your youth. So that has an ability to reorient the values of a community, reorient them from the things that had been the center of their previous religious beliefs into focusing on Christian and, in this case, American values for the most part.
Some theorists today say that one of the reasons that Native American communities have high rates of suicide and alcoholism, you can trace it back to this cultural genocide, that when you remove someone's culture, land, history, that it has impact for generations to come. How do you view that kind of thinking?
I think there's a lot of merit to that. And I think even beyond the cultural assault, by perpetrating the cultural assault, claiming that Natives are somehow savage or inferior and need to be taught civilization, you're also reiterating the message over and over that you're less than and you're unworthy. And in the United States, you're saying you're less than citizens who are Christians, and you are unworthy of full citizenship simply because you were born Native. So this is an assault on your identity and your culture, and makes people ashamed of who they are, which is certainly not what needs to be happening. So by committing this cultural genocide, you're creating problems long term by the whole undergirding belief is in inferiority.
But by talking about, you know, the problems with missionization, the impact it had on Indian communities, are there some people who say, oh, you're rewriting history, you're demonizing people who thought they were doing a good thing?
I think what you have to do is look at this from both sides. I definitely think missionaries thought that they were doing important work. And it's important to know that missionaries in the United States were part of a broader missionization attempt that was going on globally at the time. So they certainly weren't living in a vacuum. But you also have to know that, again, this is based on a hierarchy of civilizations and races, and the idea that Europeans and then American derivatives of that are the most civilized people, and everyone else must conform to be like them to be valuable members of humanity. And so by basing this on a hierarchy, you are committing an assault on people, and that comes at a price. And so I think you have to look at it both ways. Individual people that were part of this may have had good intentions, but they're buying into a view that's based on hierarchy and inferiority. And what this means for Native families and Native kids is an enormous suffering. And that suffering doesn't just go on those individuals. It goes on for generations, and it forces creative methods of resistance for people to preserve what they can in the face of that. So I think what we have to look at is not that this is a rewriting of history, but that this is looking at a variability of sources. And what is one person's success is sometimes another's failure and another's impoverishment and suffering. And so by looking at both of those sides, you can see both the intents and the outcomes of historical actions.
Ty Edwards, thank you for being with us on KC Currents.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Ty Edwards is Assistant Professor of History at Johnson County Community College. Find more details on the KC Currents page of our website at kcur.org.
If you can't listen to all of KC Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives, and we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
And now it's time for My Farm Roots, a series by Harvest Public Media. These are American stories and memories of rural life.
This latest installment is from Hillary Stowes Krause.
I met Aaron Traister on his farm out in north central Nebraska. He's a young guy, not quite 30, but he's lived almost his entire life on the farm. After graduating from college with a degree in chemistry, Traister returned to his hometown. He and his dad run the operation together, farming 5,000 acres just off the Nebraska sandhills. He says this year was tough with the drought, but he's glad he came back.
I'm Aaron Traister. I live in O'Neill, Nebraska. That's north central Nebraska. I live with my wife, Jennifer, daughter, Julia, and newborn baby, Barrett. Yeah, all through grade school, I remember I wanted to farm, and then I went to college and had a few different ideas, but I came back here. I went to Creighton University in Omaha, and I have a chemistry degree, and I did apply for med school for a year, and I got on a wait list, but I never did apply again. While I was applying to med school, I was back here helping on the farm and just learned to like it more, and I was getting married, so it's kind of a good time to come back and settle down. We don't have cattle, so the wintertime, I have more time to be around the house and go on trips and do those things, but it's kind of frustrating because she's a teacher, and I mean, summer's her time off, and wintertime is my time off, so that's conflicting. But when you catch rain in the summertime, you got a few days off. This year, that didn't happen much. The management's been getting so much easier. You have computers and the internet. The tractors run off GPS, and they can just drive a perfectly straight line within an inch. Even these systems, you can upgrade them to so you can check them on your iPhone or computer at home. That's becoming a lot more popular. Yeah, my dad hasn't adapted the technology yet. We first got the tractors with the auto steer so they could drive themselves when I came back, and I don't think he would have if I would not have chosen to come back to farm. So he kind of takes a step up and buys that stuff to help out. Where I understand it, it really does help out. Well, it's just been almost like a panic all season long, just making sure your irrigation systems are running just all the time, because even with them running, the crop's starving for water and the yield's getting hurt, so if the irrigation systems are stopped, you just have to get them going right away, no matter what it takes. I guess I'm only 29, but it's the worst I've seen, and the old-timers, they talk about it as bad as much they've seen since 56. And I guess it just makes a lot of work out of things.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media stations across the Midwest. To hear more My Farm Roots stories or to share your own, visit harvestpublicmedia.org/myfarmroots.
Still to come, getting to know the Kansas City Symphony's new assistant conductor. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. In area news this week, the candidates for Senate clashed, old houses crashed down, and the standing of Hickman Mills schools fell. Frank Morris has those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
The candidates for Senate in Missouri, Senator Claire McCaskill and Representative Todd Akin, debated for the first time on Friday. First question to Representative Akin, what about your comment that women are able to keep themselves from getting pregnant in instances of so-called legitimate rape?
Well, I've answered this question repeatedly, and I don't believe that this election overall is about talk, but it's really about two visions of what America is. That's what this election is really about. It's not about words. It's about two different voting records that are the exact opposite.
McCaskill basically agrees. She says Akin's words aren't the issue.
He has apologized for those comments, but they say a lot about how he views things, and that's where Missourians need to pay attention. I believe a rape victim should be allowed to have emergency contraception in order to avoid pregnancy. Todd Akin does not.
McCaskill leads Akin in most polls. Kansas City got a little more serious about clearing vacant buildings this week. In fact, Mayor Sly James hopped into an excavator and slammed into an abandoned house.
This is just tear the sucker down, get a bulldozer, load it in a truck, and haul it off. But we're going to try to do this the right way.
Goal is to knock down 160 derelict buildings by spring and clear a 1,000 building backlog in 2 years. Monday, Overland Park announced that a woman from South Carolina had been murdered there earlier in the month and that the suspect was already in custody in Columbia, the country, not the town. Francesca Brown was in town for a medical conference at a hotel on College Boulevard. Police believe that John Hodges, who's also from South Carolina, met her there. Hodges was extradited from Columbia and appeared in court Friday. Metro Squad detectives spent much of the week trying to figure out who killed an AT&T employee as he worked very early Wednesday morning in Gladstone. Kevin Mashburn was apparently struck in the head with something heavy. He was 58 and had been working for the company since he was in high school. AT&T is offering a $100,000 reward for information. Mashburn's union has set up a memorial fund. Missouri education officials voted to strip the Hickman Mills School District of full accreditation. The district will slip to provisional accreditation at the first of the year. He's not polling well in Kansas, but President Barack Obama will at least be on the ballot there. The Kansas Objections Board this week formally ended a review of a complaint filed by a Manhattan man. After reviewing documents from Hawaii, Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach says he has no doubts that the president's citizenship is valid, but he says that the board had to investigate the claim.
That's the nature of the board. Our board has to entertain all objections, whether they be weak objections or strong objections. We have a duty to the people of Kansas under state law to investigate every objection and make a determination.
Mitt Romney made a brief stop at a Kansas City airport. The Republican presidential nominee touched down after a crash at the Pueblo airport prevented refueling there. Aides served barbecue. It was Jack Stack. This is KCUR.
The journey of a young prince is the subject of the musical Pippin, which opens the Kansas City Rep's 48th season this month. It's been 40 years since the debut of the original Broadway production, and the creative team behind the Rep's presentation is hell-bent on bridging the cultural gap between the music and dance of the early 70s and the contemporary styles of today. KCUR's Steve Walker reports.
When Bob Fosse's production of the Stephen Schwartz Roger O. Herson musical Pippin opened its four-and-a-half-year run in October of 1972, its folk-pop sound seemed right in step with the beats of the time. When Kansas City Rep Artistic Director Eric Rosen discovered the show about a decade later, its story of a young prince's search for meaning and validation obsessed him.
I've loved Pippin since I was a kid. There was a 1982 recording of the Fosse production that I watched probably every day for a couple of years when I was 12 or 13. Pippin's story is, he starts off by saying, I need to find something extraordinary to do with my life, and I feel empty and vacant if I can't find my thing. And I think that's such a trope of all of Western literature for the past 150 years, of a hero character taking a journey to find fulfillment and ultimately having to change his expectations. Pippin's sort of endless running against the wall and hitting himself in the head felt like me.
Rosen says, though, that he and Pippin became estranged for about 20 years. But when he began to think about revisiting the show, he knew he'd have to update its look, feel, and sound. For it's a show that, if you just listen to the score, sounds frozen in the 1970s.
We've changed the conceptual frame from the sort of 70s hippie folk rock style to this kind of really driving contemporary sound and rock concert feeling that feels like the everything that happened in music from 72 over the last 40 years has changed how we feel about music and what it expresses and what we can do in the theater. So what might have felt really contrastingly dark in that very light musical style, since our musical style is more aggressive, the play feels like it's matched to what it says.
Toward realizing the ambiance of a rock concert, Rosen and his creative team put the band on stage and instruments in his actors' hands. Stage lights that would normally be hidden from the audience jut out into full view from each side of the proscenium. At a recent rehearsal, the cast, led by Claiborne Elder, run through the song Morning Glow. Another way the Rep is modernizing its Pippin is in the dance. Brought in from New York is 29-year-old Chase Brock, whose visceral and youthful choreography can currently be seen in Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark on Broadway. Brock says as much as he respected Pippin's original choreographer, the late Bob Fosse, it was important that he stray far from Fosse's iconic style.
What was exciting about this is when Eric asked me to do it, my, I think, first question was, can I not do anything that Bob Fosse did? Can we go as far away? You know, and he said, absolutely, I don't want to do that version. I want us to do our version. And I actually feel like that's less about reinventing and more about making the story speak to our times in the way that it spoke to its times in 1972. I would never want to do my watered-down imitation of anybody else. And I feel like wanting our audiences to have an experience that feels totally authentic and genuine and fresh.
Director Eric Rosen says Pippin has been one of the hardest shows he's ever cast. He needed actors who could both sing, play instruments, and dance Brock's dances, a style Rosen tags as a mosh pit at a performance art event. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
The Kansas City Rep's production of Pippin runs through October 7th at the Spencer Theater. The style of the Kansas City Symphony's new assistant director, Aram Demirjian, has been described as spirited and lively. He's also known for his keen musicianship. Demirjian will conduct more than 40 concerts this season, including the Family and Pop series. KCUR's Julie Dinesche stopped by a recent performance and has this profile.
The most exciting aspect of conducting is that moment right before the sound happens. Right before the sound happens in a performance, when you've walked out on stage, the audience has given you a warm welcome, the orchestra has stood up, sat down, and there's total silence in the room for a moment, and there is this palpable energy. Hi, my name is Aram Demirjian. I am the new assistant conductor of the Kansas City Symphony. People are the number one reason why I got into professional music. Sitting in youth orchestra as a cellist when I was a teenager, my favorite part of playing in an orchestra was feeling those connections to the 99 other people in the orchestra and feeling the connections to the audience when we were in performances and feeling how sometimes completely unexpectedly with a certain note or a certain solo or a certain melody or a certain moment, everybody in the room changed together and everybody in the room realized when something special was happening. And there's something magical about that kind of synergy that I don't feel like you find in any other type of setting besides a symphony orchestra. I wanted to become a conductor to facilitate as many of those types of connections as possible. You have to remember, the conductor is the only person of the 85 to 100 people on that stage that does not make any sound. It's a humbling thought. So I view my job as facilitating the music, as facilitating the process. When one listens to classical music, it's not something, it's not like sitting and listening to a lecture. It comes at you and you must appreciate it. You bring something to the experience. I think a common misconception about classical music in all generations, but particularly in my generation, is that classical music is somehow an exclusive art. It's somehow an elite art, and I firmly do not agree with that. I think classical music is for everybody. It is for all of us. Topics of classical music are topics that every person, whether they play in a symphony orchestra or they've never heard the sound of a violin. They are ideas and emotions that every person can identify with and has experienced. Love, death, exuberance, flirtation, and any type of emotion that people feel, these composers felt, and they poured it into their music. And that's what classical music is. The warmth of the reception that I have received from audiences has just been beyond anything I could imagine. So thank you to anybody who's listening, who's been to a performance already, or who will be coming to a performance. I am looking forward to the many, many musical experiences that we are going to share in the coming season.
Aram Demirjian is the new assistant conductor of the Kansas City Symphony. He spoke with KCUR's Julie Danishay. You can find a video and extended interview in the arts and culture section of our website, kcur.org. We want to thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan and Alex Smith. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Zach Lewandowski is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.